Welcome to this continuing medical education audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of HIV Glasgow 2018 that provides a quick audio summary of the most essential data presented at the 2018 HIV Glasgow Drug Therapy Congress. This independent CME activity is jointly provided by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral-Led Inc. Support for this program has been provided by an independent educational grant from Gilead Sciences Medical Affairs. This program is produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral-Led Inc. It is not a session created by or presented at HIV Glasgow 2018, and it is not sanctioned by the organizers of HIV Glasgow 2018. After completing this activity, the participant should be able to review data reported at HIV Glasgow 2018 for counseling, testing, and antiretroviral treatment to prevent HIV infection, especially in underserved communities. Relate in a clinical setting findings from key studies on HIV/AIDS diagnosis, management, and treatment presented at HIV Glasgow 2018. Employ strategies based on studies and data presented at HIV Glasgow 2018 for helping HIV-positive patients in medically underserved communities link to and stay in appropriate and effective HIV care. Discuss with patients and colleagues the studies and data on therapies for HIV/AIDS presented at HIV Glasgow 2018, and use that discussion to decide on appropriate planning of therapy for patients with HIV/AIDS. Our distinguished faculty for this program includes Drs. Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania, Jürgen Rockstra from the University of Bonn, Jose Arribas from the Hospital de la Paz, Graham Moyle and Marta Bofido from Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, and Renslow Scherer from the University of Chicago. The Postgraduate Institute for Medicine requires all faculty participating in this activity to disclose any real or apparent conflict of interest they may have as related to the content of this activity. All faculty disclosures can be reviewed on the homepage of this program. In support of improving patient care, this activity has been planned and implemented by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral-Ed Inc. Postgraduate Institute for Medicine is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. Please refer to the program homepage for information on the specific amount of AMA PRA Category 1 credits offered for this activity. Thank you for your time. The podcast will now begin.
Hi, this is Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania sharing with you some data from the HIV Glasgow 2018 conference and from the recently completed HIV Research for Prevention R4P meeting that was held in Madrid. So I'm going to start by talking about some PrEP implementation and effectiveness, and I'm going to share with you some of the fast-track goals from the UN AIDS Organization. These are the targets for 2020. By that period of time, the goal is to have 32 million people worldwide on antiretroviral therapy, and we're about two-thirds to that goal, so we're doing pretty good. The goal is to have 29 million people worldwide with virologic suppression. We're 60% towards that goal. In sub-Saharan Africa, the hope is that there will be 47 million men who will undergo voluntary circumcision, only a third to that goal. And ultimately, we'd like to have less than 500,000 new infections by 2020. We're far away from that goal. But with respect to PrEP, there are now PrEP targets, and the goal is to have 3 million people on PrEP by the year 2020. We're only 6% towards that goal. If you look at PrEP implementation in a global perspective, there are now 68 countries where some PrEP is available. There have been 80 implementation studies. There are global guidelines. About 309,000 people have initiated PrEP worldwide, and there have been 44 countries that have provided regulatory approval. The AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition has organized a website called PrepWatch, www.prepwatch.org, where they will update the numbers of individuals on PrEP in relationship to the targets for countries and regions. And if you look to see how successful various regions are, the current target in North America is to have 226,000 people on PrEP. We're about 220,000 people on PrEP and counting now, so we're well on our way to meeting that target. In Europe, The target is 19,000 with about 15,000 people on PrEP. But in other parts of the country, the numbers of individuals on PrEP is really lagging. In sub-Saharan Africa, the target is 141,000 and only about 49,000 of people who are on PrEP. But PrEP is moving forward in a global way. At the HIV R4P meeting, we had an update, a meta-analysis looking at 46 studies that have looked at daily tenofovir emtricitabine for PrEP that included over 10,000 individuals, 76% of whom were men. There were 91 incident infections in the individuals who were prescribed PrEP, but 27 were more than 30 days after the last PrEP dose, and 17 occurred within the first 3 months of starting PrEP. So it's possible that some of these individuals had acute HIV infection when started PrEP. So if you look at the rates of HIV acquisition that were reported in these studies, the rate was about 0.64% of HIV infection. That's in men, a little higher in women, 0.81, 1.6% among transgender individuals. And then if you look at data of from dry blood spots, they were able to look at the levels of tenofovir diphosphate, the active form of tenofovir in dry blood spots in 49 individuals who became infected. In 43%, there was no tenofovir level measured. And in 51%, the level of tenofovir diphosphate was less than 350 femtomoles per punch, which is less than two doses per week. So it's clear that non-adherence is driving a lot of the new infections that are occurring in individuals on PrEP. At the Glasgow conference, we saw some data on PrEP safety. These were data from 13 large randomized clinical trials with over 15,000 participants and 22,000 person years of follow-up. Looking at the overall rate of serious adverse events, it was 16.8% in the control arm and 17.4% in the PrEP recipient, so no statistically significant differences. There was no statistically significant difference with respect to bone fractures in these two studies, or grade 3 increases in creatinine, which were quite low, 0.1% of PrEP participants, and the same percentage, 0.1%, in individuals who were on the control arm. There was, however, a small increased rate of 1 to 4 level increases in creatinine, 4.3% in the PrEP arm, and 2.3% in the control arm. So PrEP is safe and effective. How does it work in a real-world situation? So let's look at the experience of the Fenway practice, an LGBT community health center in Boston. And between 2012 and 2017, there were 16,128 individuals who were HIV uninfected following a test, and 3,965 initiated PrEP. The PrEP users were more likely to be men. 81.5% of PrEP users were men, and only 1.4% were women. They didn't have data on gender in 17%. And it was predominantly a white population. The age range was mostly individuals age 25 and older. Only about 12% were less than 25. HIV incident rate among individuals who were not on PrEP was 1.34%, and among the PrEP users, it was 0.43%, 17 infections. If you look at these individuals who became infected while on PrEP, 12 discontinued PrEP more than 1 month prior to the infection. One individual became infected during a one-month period when he had stopped taking PrEP. There were three individuals that had possible acute infection and one individual who had missed some doses. So PrEP in this observational study was really quite effective. I want to switch gears. I want to talk a little bit about broadly neutralizing monoclonal antibodies, which are now being studied for HIV treatment, for curative research, and for prevention. I want to talk about one study that looked at a combination of antibodies, 3BNC117, which is targeting the CD4 binding domain, and 101074, which targets the V3 glycan on the HIV envelope. And they studied 11 individuals who received the combination of these two antibodies, and those folks who received the combination had a delay in virologic rebound. These were individuals who came into the study with viral loads less than 50 copies. They had virus that was sensitive to both bNAbs, and individuals who got the combination had a delay in virologic rebound after stopping antiretroviral therapy by 21 weeks compared to individuals who had no antibodies but just interrupted therapy. So these drugs may be effective as long-acting maintenance therapy. So in this context of discussing long-acting antivirals, I want to share with you some data. First, data from a study performed by the HIV Prevention Trial Network, HPTN-077. This is a study of injectable cabotegravir. It was a pharmacokinetic study, and one of the goals of the study was to understand what happens to the tail of cabotegravir. Cabotegravir is a very long-acting integrase inhibitor, and we're interested in seeing how drug concentrations persist after the last injection. So there were two cohorts in the study. One cohort received injections every 12 weeks. One cohort received injections of cabotegravir every 8 weeks, and they followed individuals for a 76-week period of time after the last dose. From the men who participated in the study, if you look at 12 weeks after the last dose, 74% still had concentrations that would consider to be protective, but by 1 year, 61% had no detectable levels. However, 40% still had some measurable concentration of cabotegravir, and if individuals taking cabotegravir for prevention became infected, they would be at risk of acquiring HIV infection. In women, the drug lasts a little bit longer because there's more fat in the muscle injection site in women than in men, and the drug is released more slowly. So at 24 weeks, at 12 weeks after the last injection, again, you've got almost everybody, 98% of individuals with protective concentrations. But by 48 weeks, you have only 23% of women with no levels, and you've got about 74% of the population with a level that would put them at risk for developing resistant virus if they became infected. And by 76 weeks, so almost a year and a half after the last dose, over 40% of individuals still had measurable levels. What was really exciting at this meeting, we saw some data looking at some new really long-acting strategies. One, a implantable rod that could be inserted in the arm with a needle trocar, and some PK data in rabbits that suggested that the tenofovir diphosphate concentrations could persist for over 2 months. That was as long as the study was conducted in animals that had an implantable polymer placed. And then a very exciting new formulation, in situ forming implants, which is a liquid polymer, in this case incorporating dolutegravir, that once injected under the skin solidifies and then slowly releases the dolutegravir concentrations. Other drugs could be formulated in a similar way. The hardened polymer can be removed if there is an adverse event. And there was some data that showed that over a four-month period of time, the polymer continued to release drug and maintain therapeutic or preventative concentrations. So that's a little bit of update from these two meetings on hot topics and HIV prevention. Thank you.
This is Jose Rivas reporting from the HIV conference that was being held in Glasgow, UK. There were interesting presentations about antiretroviral treatment, and one of the late breakers has been ANRS study performed in Cameroon, comparing in antiretroviral naive participants a regimen of TDF, 3TC, and dolutegravir 50 milligrams versus TDF, 3TC, and efavirenz, but instead of the dose of 600 milligrams, the dose of 400 milligrams. This dose has been proven in the past to be non-inferior to the 600 milligrams dose and is probably associated with less adverse event. What it is extremely interesting about this clinical trial is that it's being performed in a population that we seldom see in clinical trials performed in resource rich countries. It's an open-label trial and enrolled more than 600 participants. The majority were females, 68%. This is in sharp contrast with the mostly male clinical trials performed in Europe and the United States. And almost 10% of the participants were co-infected with hepatitis B. The other very striking baseline factor is that the majority of the participants were above 100,000 copies per ml at baseline, reaching almost 70% of the patients. And very important number, 30% of the participants were above 500,000 copies per ml. CD4s were also lower than we are used to see in registrational trials of antiretroviral therapy, and almost one-third of the participants were below 200 CD4 cells. So we are comparing here the recently recommended WHO dolutegravir-based regimen versus efavirenz 400 in a population that is very difficult to treat. The trial was designed to prove the non-inferiority of dolutegravir versus efavirenz, and the main endpoint was the proportion of participants with viral loads less than 50 at week 48. So in the dolutegravir arm, this endpoint was reached by 75% of the participants compared to 69 in the efavirenz 400. So dolutegravir did prove non-inferiority, although it couldn't prove superiority over efavirenz 400. What is very important is that there was a very close relationship between the viral load at baseline and the efficacy of the regimens. Only in participants with viral loads of less than 100,000 copies per ml, there was a response rate close to 90%. In participants above 100,000 copies per ml, response rates were in the range of 66%, and in those with more than 500,000 copies, response rates were rather disappointing, not reaching even 60% in both arms. So there were more participants in the dolutegravir arm suppressed below 200 copies per ml than in the efavirenz arm. There were patients that were genotyped, and this is an important issue because genotype was performed according to the WHO recommendation of genotyping participants with viral loads about 1,000 copies per ml. And there were 3 participants in the dolutegravir arm that were genotyped compared to 16 in the efavirenz arm. But it is very important also to remark that out of these 16 participants that were genotyped in the efavirenz arm, there were 6 that had a primary resistance because they did a genotype also in the baseline sample and there were NRTI mutations. So the rest of the 10 participants on the efavirenz arm who had this viral load about 1,000 copies, 9 had NRTI resistance. So in summary, the trials prove that dolutegravir is a good option in this population of participants. That probably is a better option than efavirenz, but is somewhat worrisome that in this very advanced population there is a substantial number of participants that were not undetectable after 1 year. So we saw also a comparison of 2 recommended regimens in guidelines, bictegravir FTC-TAF versus dolutegravir FTC-TAF, and we have seen this trial before. But in this conference, we've seen the 2-year update. Basically, there were no significant differences. The trial proved non-inferiority of bictegravir also at 96 weeks with very high efficacy rates and with very few discontinuation due to adverse events and not a single participant developing resistant mutations during the trial. There have been also interesting presentations on dual therapy with dolutegravir 3TC. We have seen an analysis of the ACTG-5353 trial looking at the speed of viral decay in participants exposed only to dolutegravir 3TC and comparing it with triple therapy based on dolutegravir 3TC and other nucleoside triple therapy in the SPRING 1 and in the single study. Take-home message is that the speed of viral decay was the same with dolutegravir 3TC than when dolutegravir was given with 2 nucleosides. And also, we saw an interesting sub-analysis of the Gemini trials looking at participants with different baseline characteristics. The Gemini trial compared dolutegravir 3TC versus dolutegravir TDF-FTC. And what we have seen here is that the viral load baseline did not predict the results of the trial. Patients about 100,000 copies per ml and below 500,000, that was the limit for entering the trial, did as well on the dolutegravir 3TC that on the dolutegravir TDF FTC. What is new is that we have seen that in both Gemini trials, Gemini 1 and Gemini 2, participants with less than 200 CD4 cells had less viral response than participants in this CD4 strata that took the dolutegravir TDF FTC. Although the differences are not due to virologic failures, there was just a single patient that failed with virologic failure in the dolutegravir 3TC arm. And the rest, the majority of the reasons for not having a viral load undetectable at week 48 in this group with less than 200 CD4s were really not virologic failures, were a mixture of having a detectable viral load that later on became undetectable, or also discontinuation due to adverse events, discontinuation also due to protocol violations, and discontinuation due to administrative reasons. So it's true that it happened in both trials, Gemini 1 and Gemini 2. It's true also that there is a small number of participants with less than 200 CD4, and I think for the time being, it's fair to say that we need more data about the utility of dual therapy in participants with less than 200 CD4s. Thank you.
Hi, this is Jürgen Rockstroh. I'm from the Department of Medicine, University of Bonn, and I'm reporting back some new issues around salvage therapy and co-infections here from the HIV Glasgow 2018 conference. So let me start with some of the new data which was presented as late breakers in the area of salvage therapy. Now, admittedly, the number of patients who are failing and need new drug classes may be declining, but I guess everyone still has that one patient from the past who went through various drug development trials and has developed extensive resistance over time. So there's always sort of a need for new drug classes and actions and new active components which we can use to compose new therapies in failing patients. So the data which was presented here was from BRIGHT. That's a phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled double-blind trial, which is looking at the new attachment inhibitor fostemsavir, which is given as 600 milligram orally BID. And this study really had two arms. The one was a randomized cohort. So these were patients who were highly treatment experienced, failing a current regimen with a viral load above 400, but still one or two ARV classes remaining and at least one fully active and available agent per class. And then there was the non-randomized cohort, which were highly treatment experienced participants, which were failing their current regimen, again, with a viral load above 400, but really had zero ARV classes remaining and no remaining fully active approved agents. The patients in the randomized cohort were randomized 3-1 to either placebo or fostemsavir plus failing regimen for 8 days and then received open-label fostemsavir 600 milligram BID plus optimized background therapy. And in the non-randomized arm, all patients immediately received fostemsavir plus optimized background. Of note, when you look at the baseline characteristics, we're really talking of very advanced patients. The number of patients who had a CD4 count below 20, so obviously very, very low, was in total for the two arms was 30%, obviously higher in the non-randomized cohort, which were even more advanced than the ones who were participating in the randomized cohort. There also was a significant amount of patients who were above 50 years, again reflecting that these patients had been HIV infected for a very long, long time. If you look at the prior ARV exposure and initial optimized background therapy, you can see that in the randomized trial, there were practically all patients had been exposed and failed NRTI, NNRTI, and PIs. There were few patients remaining who had not been treated with an integrase inhibitor yet. A larger proportion who hadn't been exposed to CCR5 antagonists, but keep in mind that probably a lot of these patients were X4 tropic. And in the non-randomized course, so the more advanced patient population, already 70% had been treated with T20, a fusion inhibitor. So really, if you look at the fully active and available ARV agents in the initial OBT, there were, per protocol definition, still quite some agents, mostly one or two for the randomized cohort, but hardly any at all in the non-randomized cohort. If you look at the virologic response rates, which were reported here up to week 48, and that was new in the observed analysis, you can see quite some impressive response rates, obviously in the patients who still had some, at least few remaining active components. There were 62% in the observed analysis, which were undetectable, below 40 copies at week 48. It was somewhat lower in the non-randomized cohort, but again, 48%, I think, for that extensively treated group was quite impressive. Looking at further additional presentation here at the conference, looking at the virologic response at week 48 by subgroup, you can see that patients who were somewhat older respond a little bit better, females respond somewhat better, Black patients respond somewhat better, and then there was a somewhat lower response in patients with particularly low CD4 counts and higher viral load, which are both markers which we know represent a higher challenge than patients with lower viremia and higher CD4 counts. Another interesting presentation, again in a salvage setting, was an analysis looking at patients completing the ibalizumab phase 3 trial and entering the Expand Access program. This again is a new molecule. It's a human monoclonal antibody which targets the CD4 binding and is a post-attachment inhibitor. This compound is now licensed since spring this year in the U.S., so far not in Europe. And in this relatively complex study, patients received a loading dose, which was really a functional monotherapy for ibalizumab, at day 7 and then at day 21. That was then combined with a fully active ARV in an optimized background regimen. The primary endpoint of the study was achieving more than a half log reduction at week 2. And then obviously a lot of safety and tolerability data was gathered as well. You see that in this trial, the baseline characteristics again show a very advanced patient population. The median duration of HIV infection was 23 years. The median viral load was 4.6 logs, so relatively high, and the median CD4 count was 73 cells, so clearly a quite advanced patient population. There was a very broad resistance against NRTI and NRTMPI, as you would expect, but also a huge amount of resistance against CCR5 inhibitor Maraviroc, 88% by Trofel test, and there were also 68% who were resistant to integrase inhibitors. So overall, a very extensively pretreated and highly resistant patient population. And if we concentrate on the results of the Expand Access here, looking at the patients who went on to week 48 in the extension phase, you can see that indeed an impressive amount of patients who remained in this study, 67%, were able to obtain and maintain a viral load below 50 copies. And I think that is really quite impressive considering the few options these patients had. And this is at least encouraging for patients who have this long duration of HIV therapy, followed sort of the introduction of various drug classes, accumulated resistance over time because of the lack of the availability of suppressive regimens, and now really are facing some interesting and very exciting options currently or in the near future. So I think with regard to salvage therapy, I think there is quite some compelling data with fostemsavir, the new attachment inhibitor, as well as the human monoclonal antibody, ibalizumab, which show that these drugs are very promising. Some of these drugs were also given in combination in these trials I just talked about, and really I think that is sort of maybe a way forward for patients with five drug class resistance or more. With regard to co-infections, I have to say that at this conference, there was far less data than in previous conferences. Obviously, with the introduction of pangenotypic regimens, hepatitis C has really become easily treatable. The EX guidelines, so the guidelines of the European AIDS Society, were updated here at the Glasgow conference. And if you look at the table for hepatitis C treatment options, the guidelines are freely downloadable from the EX website. You can see that there is really a tendency to recommend as preferred DAA combinations the pangenotypic regimens. So glucapivir, pepentasvir, and Sofvel are really the preferred choices, in particular for genotype 2 and 3. For genotype 5 and 6 as well, although there's also a possibility of treating with sofosbuvir. And then for genotype 1, 4, you have a somewhat broader choice here, including the pangenotypic, but then obviously also albisvir gruzepivir, and sofosbuvir as well. So there really seems to be sort of a tendency now to go to the somewhat more modern regimens, in particular pangenotypic regimens, if available. And then there was also new data on the management of acute hepatitis C. And I think one of the important messages here is that previous data has suggested that a lower proportion of patients with acute hepatitis C in the setting of HIV co-infection could clear infection. It's probably only around 15%. And in account of the spread and the growing epidemic of acute hepatitis C in patients with HIV, there was a strong feeling in the guidelines group to recommend DA-based treatment immediately in persons with high risk of onward transmission. So rather not waiting until the infection becomes chronic, under consideration that the majority of patients do not experience a 2-log drop of hepatitis C RNA after 4 weeks, then that should be generally the group where treatment is recommended, because we all sort of strongly believe that this will lead to a reduction in new hepatitis C infections, particularly reinfections. And data has already been shown from Switzerland and Netherlands confirming that broader access to DA therapy also early on in acute hepatitis C was associated with a 50% reduction in new cases. Finally, there was a lot of work on STIs. I think as an HIV physician, everyone is familiar with the increased risk of, in particular, syphilis, in particular in HIV-positive MSM. This was a German presentation here at the meeting where the patients who had syphilis, 43 out of 859, had one episode in the observation period between 2000 and 2010. And it was interesting to see that the incidence increased 2.4-fold in 2016. So there seems to be even more syphilis than we had observed in the early years of the epidemic. And all of them were MSM, so also suggesting that maybe we need gender-specific screening guidelines. And of note, the serology showed a slow decrease of VDRL titer after treatment. So there seems to be differences in the kinetics of serologic response, which we have to take into account when we do our control measurements for treatment response. So in summary, with regard to co-infections, I think the preferred hepatitis C regimens are now mostly pangenotypic DA combinations. Where available, immediate DA therapy of acute hepatitis C is recommended in persons with high risk of onward transmission. There is a further increase in syphilis co-infection, particularly in younger MSM, and regular screening is obviously extremely important in this group, as more than half of the syphilis cases did not show any symptoms. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to this discussion of the HIV Glasgow Conference 2018. My name is Graham Moyle from the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London in the UK, and I'm going to be discussing about some of the adverse event things that were described at Glasgow, but also providing a review of some key abstracts from the adverse event workshop that occurred in New York a couple of weeks earlier. So interest has developed about the influence of antiretroviral drugs over weight gain, and there were several cohorts that were presented at this and the adverse event meeting that looked at factors associated with weight gain on first antiretroviral treatment regimens or in switch circumstances. So the first of those I'd like to share is from a cohort in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, which looked at individuals on their first antiretroviral treatment and looked at factors associated with weight change during that treatment regimen. So not surprisingly, there were some factors such as lower baseline weight that were influenced with greater weight gain during the course of the study. The longer individuals were on treatment during follow-up, the greater amount of weight gain, because of course that would be expected with the process of aging. But there were also some other factors that were important, particularly integrase inhibitors were associated with significantly greater amounts of weight gain relative to the reference of non-nucleoside drugs, whereas protease inhibitors were not associated with greater weight gain relative to non-nucleoside drugs. And then finally, there were some disease-related factors such as low CD4 count, baseline AIDS-defining illness, and baseline viral load that were also influential over weight gain. So this again flagged the issue around integrase inhibitors. So further data that was reported again in over 20,000 individuals initiating antiretroviral therapy in the NA Accord study. Again, they chose the non-nucleoside regimens as the control population and showed that there were significantly greater amounts of weight gain in individuals who started on protease inhibitors or integrase inhibitors. But when they split out those integrase inhibitors by individual products, they found that there was no difference between L-Vitegravir, of course boosted with Cobicistat, and non-nucleoside combinations, whereas Raltegravir and particularly Dolutegravir were associated with the greatest amounts of weight gain. So a second abstract, again, flagging integrase inhibitors, but now starting to provide some granularity around Dolutegravir, consistent with what had been seen with some of the previous reports that had tried to separate this out. And then at this conference, we had data presented from the NEAT22 study by Laura Waters, looking at individuals who were on a protease inhibitor regimen with a suppressed HIV RNA and moderate to high cardiovascular risk. And these individuals were randomized to continue their protease inhibitor for a year or switch to dolutegravir. And one of the things that was tracked was change in weight. And what was observed within the study was that individuals after switching off their protease inhibitor experienced weight gain on going on to dolutegravir, and then the group that had remained on protease inhibitors during that first 48 weeks, after they switched, they also saw a disproportionate weight gain after going over to dolutegravir. They noted that some particular factors that were associated with weight gain after switching to dolutegravir were in particular being on darunavir at baseline in the study. So we have a number of key points that arise from this that we need to think about: integrase inhibitors and weight gain, that dolutegravir appears to be the integrase inhibitor most associated with this, and that while protease inhibitor to dolutegravir switch in the NEAT study was associated with reduced calculated cardiovascular risk, it wasn't necessarily associated with protection against weight gain. Now, further data from the NEAT22 study looked at inflammatory biomarkers and other factors that changed with this switch from protease inhibitor to dolutegravir. And the things that were noted in this analysis presented by Esteban Martinez was firstly that adiponectin levels went down after switching to dolutegravir, and this in fact correlated with the weight gain that was observed in the dolutegravir arm, although previous studies that have looked at switching between protease inhibitors have also reported declines in adiponectin, as some protease inhibitors may create a short-term insulin resistance, which is then compensated for by adiponectin rises. Consistent with other data that's been seen with integrase inhibitors, including in healthy volunteers, CRP levels actually went down almost significantly in the dolutegravir group, as did the oxidized LDL levels, which are a stronger marker than LDL alone of cardiovascular risk. On the more negative side, soluble CD14 did decline in the dolutegravir arm, and this is a factor that may be protective against cardiovascular risk. So lots of other factors that were looked at in the study, none of which were significant, most notably changes in insulin. And then again from the adverse event workshop, looking at data from the Athena cohort in Holland and looking at actual events compared with calculated events by different calculators such as the Framingham Risk Calculator, the DAD modified calculator, as well as the pooled cohorts equation, showing that all of these equations provided reasonable fit to the data that was observed in the Athena cohort, but in all cases there were clusters of individuals that the calculators didn't accurately predict, so that they were adequate but not perfect in their fit in the actual data, reminding us that when we're using calculators in the HIV setting, we need to think that these calculators in particular may underestimate risk within our own population. So another theme that was present at these conferences was the issue of discontinuation of tenofovir DF. So we have two forces pulling in different directions in this regard. One is the availability of tenofovir DF in generic form, which is increasingly available in many developed countries, versus the availability of alternatives to TDF, which may include TAF-based regimens or regimens that do not include tenofovir, such as two-drug regimens or abacavir-based regimens. They looked in the ICONA Italian cohorts at about factors that were associated with discontinuation of tenofovir within their cohort, and noticed that there was an association both with the use of boosted protease inhibitors and with the use of integrase inhibitor products and tenofovir discontinuation. When they drilled down into the granularity of that, again, multiple different drugs other than efavirenz were associated with an increased risk of tenofovir discontinuation, including rilpivirine, including protease inhibitors with a booster agent, and including all three of the integrase products. Although you'll notice that there is a gradation there between the associated with risk with L-vitegravir, of course, containing a booster agent in cobicistat, being associated with a greater likelihood, whereas raltegravir was associated with a relatively lower likelihood of discontinuation. So worthwhile reminding people that, of course, tenofovir DF is not dose-adjusted, and that therefore when there's a booster drug present, that may influence the risk of an adverse event. Similarly, when we think about integrase inhibitor products, because some of them also influence renal function, that may stimulate tenofovir DF discontinuation. Several studies presented data looking at individuals who'd switched in their cohort away from tenofovir DF to TAF and the lipid elevation that occurs after that. So much of the focus has been changing from TDF to TAF and seeing benefits in terms of bone and kidney outcomes. But as reported in the clinical trials, there is also an increase in lipids because tenofovir DF has about an 8% reduction in LDL cholesterol, as reported from my study in healthy volunteers quite a few years ago. And so what we see is both a rise in LDL cholesterol, a rise in HDL cholesterol, and a rise in total cholesterol after switch, but the total cholesterol to HDL ratio overall does not change. There's also a small increase observed in triglycerides. Now, tenofovir DF has not been associated with a cardioprotective effect, so effectively what we're seeing is the return to, as it were, baseline values with lipids after this change, and it's unclear whether this is going to be something that is significant in terms of long-term risk, because we haven't been able to demonstrate that the TDF reduction is protective. A nice study looking at use of TAF in older subjects, so individuals over the age of 60, so this is a study, one of the first times focusing on that older cohort, and in this case it was looking at people who are on a TDF-based regimen and switched them over to a TAF-based regimen, in this case the formulation with L-vitegravir, FTC, cobicistat and TAF. And as with other studies that have looked at the TDF to TAF switch, there was an improvement in bone mineral densities that was observed after switch and a reduction in urinary proteins, particularly the urinary albumin creatinine ratio, which may be something important in terms of the management of comorbidities such as diabetes or hepatitis within these patients. What about the management of low bone mineral density in patients? Is the best thing to do to take away the tenofovir DF and replace it with something else? Or is it to give a bisphosphonate? So this study that Andrew Carr has presented some details of previously looked at two doses of zoledronic acid at baseline and at 1 year versus removal of tenofovir, in this case mostly to regimens that were not TAF-based. It's a relatively small study, but what they demonstrated over a 3 year period was that bone mineral density improved better with the use of zoledronate than what was observed with the removal of TDF. So we shouldn't be thinking about management of low bone mineral density exclusively as being about TDF removal. We should also think that in those with low bone mineral density, a bisphosphonate is an appropriate choice. And you can see there in terms of the number of fracture events, there was actually fewer in those who were given the bisphosphonate. And then the last thing I wanted to show was from the adverse event workshop, which is, you know, again, a potential practice point. It looked at individuals by their FEV1 respiratory function test as it declined over time in a group of individuals who'd been followed in the MAX cohort for this, and looked at their functional status and looked at their use of acute care services such as the emergency room or inpatient stay, and showed two factors. One was that individuals with less well-controlled HIV RNA are of course going to have a greater decline in their performance status and more use of these facilities. But also, even in individuals with an undetectable HIV RNA, there was a greater decline in functional status and greater use of acute medical services by their FEV status, underlining that maybe we should be thinking about monitoring FEV as one of the components of our care package in aging patients to help us identify those individuals at greater risk. So in summary, booster agents and dolutegravir, to a lesser degree other integrase inhibitors, increase the risk of tenofovir DF discontinuation. Tenofovir DF discontinuation leads to lipid increases, but also increases in bone mineral density and a decrease in albumin-creatinine ratio, so there's a mixture of good and bad that is occurring there. If you have low bone mineral density, the management is going to be bisphosphonates, as switch alone is not as good as bisphosphonates, and that perhaps we should think about tracking FEV1 in our patients to help identify those who may be at greater risk of frailty and of emergency room treatment. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Marta Buffito, and I'm talking about the clinical pharmacology data presented at the Glasgow conference. So firstly, there were some data on the fact that generic TDF and FTC tablets obtained from the internet were safe and contained the right amount of drug compared to Truvada branded by Gilead. So these were data that were important to reassure the community who is purchasing generic PrEP online. Moving on, there were quite a lot of data on polypharmacy and drug-drug interactions in aging people living with HIV in Europe. So there are data from Spain, from Madrid, showing that people who are aging with HIV are more likely to be on polypharmacy, and 10% also show red flag interactions, which mainly involve the co-administration of corticosteroids, statins, antipsychotic drugs with boosted agents, or antifungal drugs with efavirenz and nevirapine, or proton pump inhibitors and rilpivirine. Other cohorts that reported this kind of data were from Italy, from Germany, from the United Kingdom. And importantly, the most commonly prescribed drugs throughout the cohorts were mental health drugs such as antidepressants or cardiovascular drugs like statins and antihypertensive. Still in the context of co-medications, pharmacologists from Italy showed that when evaluating the concentrations of psychotropic drugs in people living with HIV versus the HIV-negative populations, there were some important implications for clinical practice. In fact, people living with HIV showed to be underexposed to antidepressants or other mental health drugs compared to people without HIV. This was especially true for citalopram, duloxetine, and olanzapine. And interestingly, when we look at whether this was true mainly for people on pusi protease inhibitors or other third agents, there is not a real difference on whether people were on a boosted PI, were on an NRTI or an integrase inhibitors, and suggesting that prescribers might fear drug-drug interactions and underdose mental health drugs, or a poor adherence to mental health drugs in people living with HIV on antiretroviral treatment. Similarly, they measured the concentrations in plasma of antiepileptics, and they showed that antiepileptics exposure was actually okay, with the exception of valproate, that showed to be underexposed in people living with HIV on the drug on valproate. So in terms of drug-drug interactions, there were data presented about the interactions between bictegravir and polyvalent cation containing antacids and supplements. And the conclusion of the data is that decreased bictegravir exposure from chelation by antacids and supplements can be attenuated by staggering the administration by plus or minus 2 hours, or administering bictegravir with food. And this is consistent with the summary of product characteristics of the drugs. Finally, data were presented on the concentrations of long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine following intramuscular concentrations in people living with HIV enrolled in the LATTE studies. And they measured these concentrations in the CSF, and they also measured HIV RNA to see whether people would achieve an undetectable viral load in the CSF. And they showed that the injectable cabotegravir and rilpivirine resulted in CSF drug levels above the IC90, and HIV RNA in the CSF was below 2 copies per mil. Although CSF drug concentrations and HIV RNA levels are important in this sanctuary, they may not replicate what happens in the brain, and this needs to be taken into consideration. Thank you very much.
This concludes our audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of HIV Glasgow 2018, which has been brought to you from Glasgow, Scotland. This program was produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viralet, Inc. This coverage is not sanctioned by the conference organizers and is not an official part of the conference proceedings. To receive CME credit for completing this activity, please go to www.cmeuniversity.com. Then click on Find Post-Test Evaluation by Course on the navigation menu, enter the CME code 13221, and complete the evaluation to receive your certificate. For more CME programming on HIV Glasgow 2018, including an on-demand conference review internet symposium, a version covering the EU perspective, and a post-conference CME dinner program series, please visit www.viraled.com. Thank you for your participation.